cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days with liquid lash extension mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple, just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows at all your favorite festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Okay, so imagine this. A baby is born, but he's not exactly your average newborn.
Not at all.
His body glows. His hair is white like wool. His eyes literally light up the room like tiny suns.
And that's not even the wildest part.
Right.
Yeah.
Moments after birth, he stands up, opens his mouth, and starts, you know, blessing the Lord.
Yeah. And his father, he's so freaked out, he thinks the baby might actually be part angel.
He panics, rushes off to his father for help. I mean, it sounds like something straight out of a fantasy novel, doesn't it?
It really does. But this is actually how the story of Noah kicks off in a really important ancient text, one you won't find in most Bibles today, the Book of Enoch.
And that is exactly where we are heading in this deep dive. We've got some key excerpts pulled from the Book of Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission really is to unpack this amazing story of Noah's birth. We want to dig into why, at least according to this source, his arrival caused such, well, alarm.
And uncover the surprising reasons given here for the Great Flood. It's maybe not what you think.
Plus, explore some truly cosmic, almost unbelievable visions Enoch has about judgment, the universe, everything.
It's like getting a totally different perspective, isn't it? A different set of liner notes for a story you thought you knew. We're going to pull out the most striking details and hopefully help you see these ancient events through a very unique lens.
Okay, let's get into it, starting right there with that incredible birth scene. So the text says Methuselah's son, Lamech, has a son. Pretty normal start.
Right, sounds standard, but then the description hits you. This child is anything but standard.
Tell us about it.
Okay, so his body, described as white as snow and red as a blooming rose. His hair, his locks, white as wool.
Wow.
And his eyes, they weren't just, you know, beautiful. When he opened them, they apparently lit up the entire house, like the sun, the whole place just glowed.
And then he acts. This newborn baby arises in the midwife's hands, opens his mouth, and starts talking.
Conversing. With the Lord of Righteousness, no less.
Mm.
Not crying, not gurgling, speaking blessings.
Which, understandably, terrifies Lamech.
Completely. The text says he was afraid. He fled, went straight to his dad, Methuselah.
And his fear is specific, isn't it? It's not just general new parent anxiety.
Oh, no. He thinks the son is, and this is a quote, strange, diverse from, and unlike man. He looks at the child and sees something resembling the sons of the God of heaven.
Okay.
He notes the child's different nature, those eyes like the sun's rays, his glorious appearance. Lamech is basically afraid the child isn't his.
He thinks he came from angels.
Exactly. Sprung from angels, not from him. And he's worried some wonder may be wrought on the earth during this child's life. He senses something huge is coming.
So his mind just leaps straight to the divine, or specifically the angelic. Something beyond human has happened here.
That's his immediate conclusion. And his solution. He begs Methuselah to go find his father, Enoch Lamech's grandfather, who, in this tradition, is said to dwell among the angels.
To get the truth.
To find out the absolute truth about this baby.
Which leads Methuselah on quite a journey.
It does. The text says he travels to the ends of the earth to find Enoch. He hears Enoch is there, cries out, and Enoch hears him and comes.
So Methuselah explains the whole situation.
Lays it all out for Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
The bizarre birth, the glowing baby, the talking, Lamech's terror that the child isn't human, or at least not fully human, looks like the angels of heaven. He's basically asking, what is going on? Is this child mine?
And this is where it gets really fascinating, because Enoch's answer, It's way bigger than just confirming paternity.
Oh, much bigger. He connects this birth to this huge cosmic drama and the real reason, according to this text, for the coming destruction.
What does he say?
Enoch tells Methuselah the Lord is about to do a new thing on the earth. He says, I've already seen this in a vision.
The vision? About what?
He links it directly back to his own father's generation, Jared's time. He says, back then, some of the angels of heaven transgressed the word of the Lord.
Angels transgressing? How? What did they do?
According to Enoch here, they committed sin, broke divine law, specifically by uniting with human women. The text says they united themselves with women and commit sin with them and have married some of them and have begot children by them. These are often called the Watchers in related traditions.
So the sons of the God of Heaven, Lamech, was worried about. This text says they were these specific fallen angels.
That's the connection being made, yes.
And the children they had with humans, what were they like?
The text says they produced giants, not according to the spirit, but according to the flesh. And because of this whole situation, the angelic transgression, their giant offspring, a great punishment is coming.
A punishment on the earth.
Yes. The earth shall be cleansed from all impurity.
So wait. In this telling, the great flood is the direct result of this angelic corruption, the mingling of angels and humans and their offspring.
Precisely. That's presented as the primary cause here. It's called a great destruction over the whole earth, specifically a deluge and a great destruction for 1 year.
Okay, so where does this incredible baby, Noah, fit into all this coming destruction?
Enoch reveals his crucial role. He says, this son, Noah, shall be left on the earth, and his three children shall be saved with him.
So when everyone else perishes,
he and his sons will survive. They will be preserved through the deluge.
So Noah's strangeness, his unique birth, it's not just weird, it's actually a sign he's set apart for this role.
That seems to be exactly the implication. And Enoch gives Methuselah clear instructions. Tell Lamech, he is in truth his son.
Okay, so he is Lamech's son after all.
Yes, and call his name Noah, because Enoch says he will be left to you, and he and his sons shall be saved from the destruction.
And the name Noah itself has meaning here.
Yes, connected to being left or remaining, but also later comfort. The text stresses the destruction comes on account of all the sin and all the unrighteousness consummated on the earth in his days. The direct consequence.
But Enoch sees even further, doesn't he? Beyond the flood.
He does. He mentions that even after this massive cleansing, there will be even more unrighteousness than before.
Really? So the flood isn't the ultimate fix in this view?
Apparently not. It doesn't permanently solve the problem of human or maybe even cosmic corruption. Enoch says he knows all this because he's been shown the mysteries of the Holy Ones by the Lord.
And he mentions reading something.
Yes. He says he has read it in the heavenly tablets.
Heavenly tablets? What are those? Like cosmic record books?
That's the idea, yeah. Like everything is written down. He says he saw on these tablets that generation upon generation shall transgress till a generation of righteousness arises and transgression is destroyed and sin passes away and all manner of good comes.
Wow, that's a long view of history. Cycles of sin and eventual restoration.
A very long view. But first, he really hammers home the message about Noah for Methuselah.
He repeats it.
Yes. Tell Lamech that this son is in truth his son, and that is no lie. Make sure he understands.
And Methuselah does this.
He does. He goes back, tells Lamech everything, and they name the child Noah. The text adds specifically, for he will comfort the earth after all the destruction. So the name also carries that sense of future solace.
Okay, so the narrative seems to jump forward then. Noah is older. And he sees the signs himself.
Right. Later, Noah sees the earth has sunk down and its destruction was nigh. The catastrophe is imminent.
And he reaches out to Enoch, even though Enoch was supposedly taken earlier.
Yeah, the timeline or perspective gets a bit fluid here. Noah goes to the ends of the earth and cries out to his grandfather Enoch. Enoch appears to him, seemingly transcending that earlier departure.
And Noah is distressed.
Deeply. He cries out three times, hear me, hear me, hear me. His question is desperate. Tell me what is falling out on the earth, lest perchance I shall perish with it. He sees it coming and he's terrified.
What happens next?
There's a great commotion, a voice from heaven. Noah falls on his face. And then Enoch is there asking him, you know, why are you crying so bitterly?
And the reason for the destruction revealed here, it adds another layer, doesn't it? Beyond just the angel stuff.
It really does. Enoch tells Noah a command has gone forth from the Lord because the people on earth have learned all the secrets of the angels and all the violence of the Satans and all their powers, the most secret ones.
Secrets. Learning secrets is part of the problem now. What kind of secrets?
The text gets surprisingly specific again. It mentions the power of sorcery, witchcraft, and making molten images. Idolatry, maybe.
Okay, mystical or forbidden arts.
But also secrets of the earth itself. How silver is produced from the dust, how soft metal originates like lead and tin. It even says these metals come from a specific fountain where an angel stands guard.
Whoa. So it's not just angels marrying humans. It's also about them sharing forbidden knowledge, like illicit technology, mystical power, even knowledge about natural resources.
That's a huge part of it in this section, yes.
Yeah.
The corruption involved sharing and misusing knowledge that was meant to be hidden, perhaps even advanced knowledge related to things like metallurgy sourced from these fallen angels.
And the consequence for learning and using these secrets?
Utter destruction. The earth and those who dwell upon it shall be destroyed. And for those involved, the angels who taught, the humans who learned, there's no turning back. They have no place of repentance forever because they have shown them what was hidden and they are the damned.
Pretty final. But Noah, again, is different.
Yes, Enoch reassures him. The Lord of spirits knows that thou art pure and guiltless of this reproach concerning the secrets. Noah didn't partake in this forbidden knowledge exchange.
And his destiny is confirmed.
Absolutely. His name will be among the holy, he'll be preserved, and his descendants are destined for kingship and for great honors. A righteous line will come from him, a fountain of the righteous and holy without number forever.
Such a stark contrast. Total doom for the corrupted, but this incredible future promised through Noah.
And then Enoch gets shown the mechanics of the judgment itself.
What does he see?
He sees the angels of punishment who are prepared to come and let loose all the powers of the waters which are beneath in the earth. They're ready to unleash the floodgates, basically.
But they're told to wait.
Right. The Lord commands them not to release the waters yet, to hold them in check. The time isn't quite right.
And God speaks directly to Noah then.
Yes. Noah hears God's voice affirming him. Noah, thy lot has come up before me, a lot without blame, a lot of love and uprightness. God essentially says, the angels are working, but I will preserve life through you.
A seed of life.
Exactly. A seed of life shall come forth, and a change shall set in so that the earth will not remain without inhabitant. Life will continue through Noah.
And his family line is secured.
Divinely secured. God tells him to fast thy seed before me forever and ever, and promises they will spread abroad, shall not be unfruitful, but will be blessed and multiply.
So what about those angels who started all this trouble, the ones who shared the secrets?
They get imprisoned, specifically in a burning valley that Enoch had apparently seen before. It's described as being in the west, among mountains known for gold, silver, iron, soft metal, and tin.
Wait, the same area associated with those metals whose secrets were revealed?
It seems directly connected, yes. That place of forbidden knowledge becomes their prison.
What's the prison like?
The text describes a great convulsion, an upheaval involving water. There's a smell of sulfur linked to fiery molten metal. This valley where the angels who led people astray are punished, it burned beneath that land with streams of fire flowing through it.
But there was something weird about the waters there, right? Something about healing and punishment.
Yeah, this is a really strange and striking paradox. The text says these waters will somehow serve earthly rulers, kings, the mighty, for healing of the body.
Healing. From a place of punishment.
Physically healing, yes. But spiritually, it's for the punishment of the spirit. It's like the powerful on earth benefit physically from this corrupted source, but it damns their spirit.
How does that work?
Their spirit is full of lust, punished in their bodies, yet they deny the Lord even while using this tainted source. They prioritize the body's desires, reject the spirit, blinded by the physical benefit.
So the very thing offering them physical comfort is tied to the ultimate source of corruption and judgment, and it blinds them.
That seems to be exactly the point. A commentary on how earthly power and physical gratification can make you completely oblivious to spiritual reality and divine judgment. The text even adds that the water temperature changes based on the angel's punishment. Gets hot when they suffer, cold when they ascend slightly.
And the archangel Michael comments on this.
He does. Michael says this whole situation, the judgment, the valley, the waters, is a testimony for the kings and the mighty. Because these waters offer them physical healing and cater to their lust, they will not see and will not believe that those waters will change and become a fire which burns forever.
They're benefiting too much in the present to see the eternal consequence.
Exactly. They're trapped by their reliance on this corrupted source.
That's incredibly dark. Okay, shifting gears slightly, the text then describes Enoch himself being elevated, right? Taken up.
Yes, his name is raised aloft to that Son of Man and to the Lord of Spirits. He's taken from among those dwelling on earth.
How?
On chariots of the Spirit. His name vanished among them. He's no longer counted as an earthly inhabitant.
Where does he go?
He's placed between the two winds, between the north and the west.
It sounds like a specific celestial location where angels are measuring out a place for the elect and righteous. And there he sees the first fathers and the righteous who have been dwelling there since the beginning. Like a realm for the departed righteous.
And then he goes even higher.
His spirit is translated, ascends into the heaven of heavens. The descriptions become even more intense. He sees holy sons of God, angelic beings stepping on flames, dressed in white, faces shining like snow.
Overwhelming, I imagine.
Totally. He sees streams of fire, light like hyacinth. He falls on his face, completely overwhelmed.
And Michael helps him again.
Yes, Michael lifts him up and leads him into all the secrets. Secrets of righteousness, the ends of heaven, the chambers of the stars and luminaries where they come from before appearing in the sky. He's getting the grand cosmic tour.
And he sees a central structure. He describes this incredible structure made of crystals with tongues of living fire flickering between them. A girdle of fire surrounds it. Streams of living fire pour out on four sides.
Guarded by angels.
Powerful ones. Seraphim, cherubim, alphanim, these classes of angels associated with God's throne. They guard it constantly, never sleeping. And around them, countless other angels, thousands, and 10,000 times 10,000. And key archangels like Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, Faniel are seen going in and out.
And then from this house, someone emerges.
Yes, the Head of Days, a title often used for God representing eternal divinity.
What's the description like?
His head is white and pure as wool, his clothing indescribable. Once again, Enoch is just floored, falls on his face, his spirit transforms, he cries out blessings, and this worship pleases the Head of Days.
And then he meets another figure, the Son of Man.
Right. The Head of Days comes with angels and greets Enoch, saying, "This is the Son of Man who is born unto righteousness." The text really emphasizes that righteousness defines him, surrounds him, and the righteousness of the Head of Days never leaves him.
And the Son of Man brings a message.
A message of peace. Peace in the name of the world to come. A peace that's eternal, existing since creation.
And the righteous are connected to him.
Yes, the promise is that all the righteous will follow his ways. Their eternal homes and heritage will be with him. They'll never be separated. Length of days, eternal peace. It's all tied to this Son of Man.
So it's this vision of ultimate hope and righteousness, a real counterpoint to all the judgment and corruption described earlier.
A powerful counterpoint, yeah. Offering a glimpse of the final restoration.
The visions keep coming, though. Uriel shows him the cosmos.
Yes, the Archangel Uriel shows Enoch the proper functioning of the universe. The sun, the moon, the stars, their leaders, their tasks, their timing, their orbits. The perfect, intended, cosmic order.
But then he sees how that order gets disrupted.
Profoundly disrupted. And the days of sinners, this perfect mechanism breaks down. Years get shorter, crops are late. Rain is withheld, fruits don't grow right, the moon cycle gets messed up, even the sun behaves erratically, shining too brightly or setting strangely.
And the stars themselves go off course.
Yes, many of the chiefs of the stars transgress their ordained order. They change their orbits, mess up their tasks, don't appear when they're supposed to. Cosmic chaos.
What's causing this? Is it just a symptom of the sin on Earth?
The text links it directly to human ignorance and error. It says, "The whole order of the stars shall be concealed from the sinners, and the thoughts of those on the earth shall err concerning them."
Meaning?
Humans misunderstand the stars, their ways become altered, they make mistakes, and crucially, they take them to be gods.
Wow. So according to this text, human error misunderstanding the cosmos, maybe even worshiping celestial bodies, actually causes the physical mechanics of the universe to go haywire.
That's the implication. It's a really unique idea, this deep connection where human spiritual or intellectual corruption directly impacts physical cosmic order.
And the result of all this disorder.
More evil and ultimately punishment to destroy all. The cosmic chaos isn't random. It's both a consequence of sin and a sign leading towards judgment.
And throughout all these incredible visions, those heavenly tablets keep coming up.
Right. Enoch is told again, Observe the heavenly tablets, read what is written thereon, and mark every individual fact. He reads it all, understands it all, the book of all the deeds of mankind, to the remotest generations.
A complete divine record of everything, past, present, future.
Seems like it. And after seeing all this, Enoch blesses God for creation, praises his patience, and blesses humanity. Especially he blesses the person who dies righteous, with no record of unrighteousness against them, who won't face a day of judgment because their slate is clean.
And then finally he returns to earth.
Yes. Seven holy ones bring him back, set him down right in front of his own house.
And they give him instructions.
Very specific ones. Declare everything you saw to your son Methuselah. Show it to all your children. And stress the point. No flesh is righteous in the sight of the Lord, for he is their creator. No one is righteous on their own.
And he has a deadline.
A strict one. 1 year we will leave thee with thy son, that thou mayest teach thy children and record for them, and in the second year they shall take thee from their midst. He has exactly 1 year to pass on these revelations.
And they offer some final words, encouragement and warning.
Both. Be strong. The good shall announce righteousness to the good. The righteous will rejoice together, but the sinners shall die with the sinners, and the apostate go down with the apostate. Clear separation of fates.
There was that line about the righteous dying because of the wicked. How does that fit?
Yeah, that line. Those who practice righteousness shall die on account of the deeds of men and be taken away on account of the doings of the godless.
Right.
Sounds odd at first.
Right.
But in the context, especially thinking about the flood, it might mean that the physical judgment brought on by widespread wickedness is so catastrophic it impacts everyone on earth.
What?
So the righteous might physically perish in that destruction, or maybe taken away, means they are removed beforehand, like Enoch himself was.
So it's not saying their righteousness fails them, but that the consequences of overwhelming sin affect the whole world.
That seems the most plausible reading, yeah. Their ultimate fate is secure, but they might still be caught up in the earthly consequences caused by others, highlighting how interconnected things are, maybe tragically so.
Okay, that makes more sense. And then the angels leave.
They cease speaking, and Enoch is back with his people, blessing the Lord. A man returned from seeing the secrets of heaven and the future of earth.
Wow. Okay, so let's just try and recap this journey we've taken through these excerpts. We started with this unbelievable baby Noah,
whose father literally thought he might be part angel.
And that detail, found in the book of Enoch, opens up this whole narrative where Noah's birth is a sign, directly tied to this major angelic transgression, angels mixing with humans, producing giants.
Mm-hmm. And where the Great Flood isn't just about general human sin, but specifically about cleansing the earth from that corruption and, importantly, from the spread of forbidden knowledge.
Right, the secret sorcery, metallurgy, things humans weren't meant to know, taught by fallen angels.
And Enoch's visions. They took us from that judgment to the fate of those angels in that burning valley with that bizarre twist about its waters healing the bodies of kings while punishing their spirits.
And then all the way up into the heavens, seeing the divine throne room, the head of days, the son of man.
And that really mind-bending concept that the physical order of the cosmos, the stars and planets, could actually be disrupted by human sin and error, by us fundamentally misunderstanding our place or even worshiping creation instead of the creator.
It just gives you such a different framework for thinking about these ancient stories, doesn't it? It adds these layers about knowledge, angelic influence, cosmic mechanics. It's complex.
Absolutely. Thinking about these perspectives really does raise huge questions. You know, what counts as forbidden knowledge? How does divine justice actually work? What about these unseen forces described so vividly?
And maybe the final thought to leave you with, building on that connection between cosmic order and human error, if this ancient text suggests that chaos in the universe is linked to our mistakes, our failures to understand or worship correctly, what might that imply about our own understanding of the universe today and our relationship with the world around us? Something to mull over.